We're joined on the phone right now as we continue this hour by Tom Jensen, who is the Director of Public Policy Polling based out of Raleigh. PublicPolicyPolling.com is their website. You can find them on social media at PPP Polls. And I'm excited about this conversation. Ordinarily, Tom joins us to talk about polling numbers and what they can tell us about the state of things in North Carolina and across the country. Today, we're going to be looking at a couple of surveys and talking about what they might not be able to tell us about North Carolina and the state of things nationally. So I'm excited about this conversation. Tom, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Aaron. Good to be with you.
And we're talking about a couple of surveys that have just come out of voters in North Carolina, I think specifically. One of these surveys, really, really good if you are a Democrat looking ahead to the 2020 election, because it shows Joe Biden with a huge lead on Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders with a huge lead on Donald Trump. And then the other survey coming out at pretty much exactly the same time, really, really good if you're a Republican looking ahead to the 2020 election, because it shows Donald Trump with like a 60% approval rate and Dan Forrest leading Roy Cooper by 10 points or something like that in the gubernatorial election. So what about these two polls? What is it that leads to these two numbers being, or these two surveys coming up with such different results? And what does all of this tell us about polling?
Sure. Well, as you say, one of these polls is really, really good for Democrats, and one of these polls is really, really good for Republicans. What they each have in common is that they're really, really wrong. North Carolina is a swing state, like it always is. The presidential race in the state's about tied. The Senate race in the state's about tied. So they're both sort of off the reservation. But to start with the one that is way too good for Republicans, I was scrolling through it, and you got at a few of the findings, but it says that Roy Cooper's down 4 to Dan Forrest. Donald Trump is up 11 on Joe Biden. Mm. So I was scrolling through this survey, sort of looking at the findings, and we get to what is your ethnicity, and 80% of the respondents are white, and 15% of the respondents are African American. Well, in North Carolina, it's more like 73% of the voters are white and 21% of the voters are African-American. So you have about 6 or 7% too many white voters, about 6 or 7% too few black voters. Well, in North Carolina, white voters tend to vote Republican by about 30 points. African-Americans tend to vote Democratic by about 90 points. So every point that your survey is too white / not African American enough is basically equivalent to 1.2 points on the margin of the poll. Mm-hmm. So right there, if you have 6% too few African Americans, your poll is going to have a 7-point bias just because of that. So that's one thing that stuck out to me, is it has a totally wrong racial breakdown. But what's really amazing about this poll that's way too good for Republicans is the age breakdown. They have 9% of the electorate being under the age of 55. So they're saying that 91% of the people who are going to vote are going to be over the age of 55. And more specifically than that, they're saying that 70% of the people who are going to vote are going to be over the age of 65.
That might end up being slightly wrong.
Generally, between 25 and 30% of voters are actually over 65. Where they have it at 70%. Usually, I would say about 60% of voters are going to be under 55, which they have at 9%. So this is basically a survey of old white people. And yes, if only old white people voted in North Carolina, Donald Trump probably would beat Joe Biden, and maybe Dan Forrest would beat Roy Cooper, but I actually think that Roy Cooper's strong enough that he might even win an election dominated by old white people. But it was not very hard to figure out how this poll got such wild findings. It was because there's just no young people, no African Americans, basically none of the groups that tend to be supportive of Democrats were nearly sufficiently polled in this survey.
What about the other survey, the one that's really good for Democrats?
So the poll that's really good for Democrats, the problem here, and it's something where you can have some sort of more of a philosophical debate about it, than the one that's too good for Republicans. Emerson College is really testing with a lot of sort of new ways of getting survey respondents. And it's important for polling companies to be testing right now with new ways of getting survey respondents. And we're doing a lot of testing right now with new ways of getting survey respondents. But usually you do that testing and figure out sort of on a sustained basis what the good new methodology is, and then you start releasing those polls in public. Emerson is sort of testing out methodologies and just throwing them out there regardless of whether the results make any sense or not. So almost half of their sample for this poll was done through something called Amazon Turk, which is it's some way of getting respondents through Amazon that I hadn't been familiar with until this poll was done. But apparently it skews significantly sort of to more college-educated people and to people more on the left in terms of the respondents it gets. So this poll ended up with Democrats just having leads that are not realistic for North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden with a 12-point lead. That's 16 points better than Hillary Clinton did in the state. So if Joe Biden was really up by 12 in North Carolina, Donald Trump would be down by 18 points nationally, which is not really in the realm for where we see things. And the other finding from the Emerson poll that was particularly eye-popping was that in the U.S. Senate race, State Senator Erica Smith had a 7-point lead over Tom Tillis, 46-39. And I certainly think that Tom Tillis is very vulnerable for re-election. I think it's going to be one of the closest, maybe the closest Senate races in the country. But it's not something like this poll portrayed where Democrats just have a huge advantage that, you know, they're going to have to blow in order to not pick up the Senate seat. We found when we test Tom Tillis against a generic Democratic opponent, it's tied. When we test Donald Trump against a variety of Democratic opponents, it comes out to an average of a 1-point Democratic lead. North Carolina was the second closest state in the country for president in 2008. It's the second closest state in the country for president in 2012. It's a little less close in 2016, but it was still only a 4-point race. So ironically, if you about average out these two polls that are both, I think, way off the mark, you get pretty close to probably what the reality of the situation is in the state.
I'm speaking with Tom Jensen, public policy polling, and this kind of raises a number of different questions about this kind of polling in general, and I've kind of noticed this. I was actually talking with Debbie Stroman about this yesterday with regard to sports journalism, how every single time you have one new game in the NBA finals, for instance, the sports reporter's narrative completely changes. The Raptors lose, and oh, that's it, the Raptors are done, and then the Raptors win, and oh, the Warriors were just a fake dynasty the whole time, and it just keeps bouncing back and forth like that. And I often see this with surveys as well. Whenever you get like a CNN survey or a public policy polling survey or any other survey that comes out that shows Donald Trump with a slightly higher approval rating or a slightly lower approval rating or any little bit of a difference, you immediately get the stories in the news. Oh, Donald Trump's got his highest approval rating in 2 years, or Donald Trump's approval rating is down 6 points in a month. And that's one survey. You got to look at all of the surveying that's coming out and compare and contrast and kind of get the general big picture. And that's true whether the methodology is accurate or in these two cases, if the methodology, especially in these two cases where the methodology isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, it sort of drives me crazy the way that the media covers polls, because there's really, I think to some extent there's incentivization for outliers. This Emerson poll that showed Democrats with eye-popping leads got a huge amount of media attention because it's a really sort of, you know, it's an interesting finding. Well, a lot of the times interesting findings are wrong and boring findings are right. Mm-hmm. Like North Carolina has consistently been one of the closest states in the country over the last decade. So that is sort of what you expect things to be. So if you get a poll out that says everything in North Carolina is really close, you know, that's not really something that's an interesting or exciting finding, I guess, to a lot of newsrooms because that's sort of how it's been. But if you get something that's really on the polar end of that, then that sort of becomes something that you can get all hyper about. And you're exactly right that the, you know, a lot of the time the same media organization on Monday will be like, oh my goodness, Trump's numbers are the worst they've ever been. And then a different poll comes out on Wednesday and all of a sudden it's, oh my goodness, Trump's numbers are the best they've ever been. His numbers have gone up 10 points in 2 days. And it's, you know, two completely different pollsters. They might have been taken on different dates. They certainly have different methodologies. So, you know, my desire as a pollster would be for the media to sort of chill out a little bit more when it comes to covering polls. But I also know that's a battle I'm going to lose. So just try not to get too irritated about it.
I get a lot of my national news from thehill.com, which I think is generally a really good website. But they're notorious about that for me every time a new poll comes out. And you're exactly right. It'll be one narrative on Monday and the other one is completely different 2 days later based on whatever survey that they're looking at. So another question that that kind of popped into my head is, as I'm hearing you describing these two particular surveys, you look at the numbers and you mentioned with the Emerson survey with a different methodology, you test the different methodology first privately, and then you release it publicly once you get a sense of if the numbers make sense. How does a pollster tell in advance if the numbers actually make sense? You're looking at like the 2008, 2012, 2016, 2018 election and trying to get a sense of what the North Carolina electorate is going to be in 2020. And the vast majority of the time that works. What do you do as a pollster if there actually is a sea change in the way that North Carolinians are looking at the election and voting and thinking about voting in 2020 versus 2 years ago or 4 years ago?
Well, you know, one reality is we don't have a lot of sea changes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So if something is that out of line with how things went 3 years ago, I think that's a pretty good clue to you that there might be something off in your sample. Something specific in the Emerson poll that I saw some national poll writers flag is that 55% of the respondents had college degrees,
mm-hmm.
When in North Carolina, it's actually more like 30-something percent of voters have college degrees, might not even be that high. And that's a big, important thing, because even within Republicans, there are huge education differences in terms of whether people are like willing to put up with Trump or not. Less educated Republicans are much more likely to stick 100% behind Trump no matter what he does. More highly educated Republicans are a lot more likely to sort of be skeptical of what Trump's doing, to have abandoned their support for him, to be thinking about leaving the Republican Party over his actions in office, those kinds of things. So what the reason that education thing matters so much is that even if you have the right number of Republicans in your sample,
mm-hmm.
if you are extremely disproportionately having more highly educated Republicans who are much more likely to be Trump skeptics, that's how you can possibly end up with a poll where even if you have the right number of Republicans overall, you have the wrong balance of people within the Republican prime party, and it ends up making Trump's situation look a lot worse than it actually is.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Tom Jensen, again, publicpolicypolling.com, the website. You can find him on Twitter at PPPpolls. Oh, one more question about the Emerson survey, and this actually has nothing to do with the numbers, but the questions that they asked, and specifically the matchups that they tested for 2020. I'm looking at the survey, and it looks like they tested Trump against five different Democrats: Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris. And more and more and more, and I'm seeing now a little bit of buzz about this on social media too, so I'm not alone in thinking this. More and more it's seeming to me that in spite of the fact that we've got 150 declared Democratic candidates for president, it seems like it's starting to narrow itself down to almost a five-person race. You've got Beto O'Rourke, who had a little bit of buzz earlier, but that's kind of dissipated. Amy Klobuchar never really caught on. Cory Booker, I like him. He would be one of my leading candidates, but he hasn't seemed to catch on. Gillibrand, kind of the same thing. And then you got a whole bunch of other candidates way in the back that haven't really caught on or gotten any buzz at all. And it really seems to be coming down to those five, Biden, Bernie, Buttigieg, Warren, and Harris. Is that your sense too, or is it too early to tell?
That's certainly my sense of the moment, but it is too early to tell. We're coming up on a historic day in the history of public policy polling. I think it's July 6th. On July 6, 2015, we did the first poll that found Donald Trump leading the Republican primary field that anyone had done. So we're still a month shy of when in 2015 Trump led in a poll for the first time. I think one of the most interesting people you mentioned in that top five is Pete Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. 3 months ago, you would have laughed at the notion that he was one of the top five candidates. So I think there certainly is still plenty of time for people to move up into that top tier and to move out of that top tier. And even within that top tier, we've seen some movement just in the last month. Like Buttigieg, I think, was pretty consistently pulling in third place in a lot of polls, maybe in the second half of April, first part of May. And now Elizabeth Warren has really moved up more towards pretty consistently being kind of the third place person. So definitely you'd rather be in that top five right now than not. But I think there's also plenty of time for that to keep shifting around.
Speaking with Tom Jensen, and we got to wrap up. But before we do, I want to change the subject and ask you about Tar Heel baseball, because you're the Tar Heel super fan. We got a big, big series coming up, weather permitting, at Bochemer Stadium this weekend against Auburn. I assume that you got in and got your tickets before they sold out. But what's your take on the series this weekend?
Well, I think that UNC is very hot right now. They're certainly in one of their best stretches of the season, and hopefully the chaos with the weather this weekend won't do anything to break up that momentum. Some of the problems I'm sort of anticipating are, you know, a game gets played in three chunks with the way that the weather is going right now. Like maybe you start a game at noon on Saturday and you play three innings and you have to wait 3 hours for it to stop storming, and you play another three innings and you have to wait 3 hours for it to stop storming. I mean, I hope nothing that crazy happens, but that really sort of has the potential to mess with your pitching plan. I actually think in some ways that could benefit the Tar Heels, though. The Heels took a very interesting pitching strategy last Saturday in the winner's bracket game against Liberty, where they just threw a bunch of guys two or three innings. So that's something, rather than having a starter go really deep into the game, that's something that if you have weather chaos, it's good that UNC has the relievers and the pitching depth to go with an approach like that. Certainly, you know, Auburn was not expected to win a regional, so they sort of have that same kind of thing going on that the Heels do right now, where they have a lot of momentum. So we'll just have to see who's carries them further. I think that UNC is the stronger team, but there have certainly been times in the postseason where UNC beat some teams that were clearly better than them, and as will happen in baseball, they've lost to some teams who they were better than. So I certainly would predict that the Heels will win after a crazy weather weekend, but we very much know to expect the unexpected. The other really interesting thing developing is that you could potentially have a side of the bracket in Omaha that's Duke, UNC, and East Carolina all on the same side of the bracket.
Nice.
So that would be pretty amazing.
publicpolicypolling.com or at PPP polls on Twitter for more numbers from PPP. More on Tar Heel baseball at goheels.com. Tom Jensen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Aaron. Take care.